Thank you. Supposed to acknowledge the crowd and everything, and I just want you to know that I know that it's not that I'm, because there's a hostility that develops if you don't say anything. I'm not trying to ignore everybody. I just don't have anything to say, which is, we'll discover later on, or at least I will. I always do that. Not having anything to say is really kind of a blessing in my so that I can figure out what I'm supposed to play next. Since I haven't said anything, I haven't discovered what I'm supposed to play next. I don't have a set list. It's one of the privileges and advantages of playing solo. It's also one of the drawbacks of playing solo, but more for you than for me. Thank you. written for, I play this all the time. I'd like to stop playing it because of how much I play it. You get to do certain things on a vocal that you can't do anywhere else, so in this case, you get to do that over and over and over again. This was written for a wedding by Eddie Reeves and Alex Sharp.
Sitting in no time.
I did it 2 days ago, but I haven't until then done it for about 15 years, maybe more. I was sort of roped into doing this. So that the guy whose show I was doing could sing along. And every verse, nothing happened. There was no other voice. And then on the last verse I heard, saved me considering, you know, everything I'd done up to. Thank you. Stuff as that rocket that was just sent up into space by a private company. If it can withstand that, it could probably stand up as a guitar. I have a lot of trouble with airlines. They can't hurt this one. They can, but it takes a lot more effort than they're willing to expend. They only have so much time. If there are any guitar players here, you should never check your guitars on an airline that is going to land or depart from Concourse B in the Denver airport. Never. I've lost 4 guitars in that concourse in the last, I think, 3 years. The last time, and when I finally figured it out, that it wasn't the baggage handlers, I was getting ready to go on the plane, and they said, "Oh, are you... did you check a guitar?" I said, "Yeah." And they said, "No." They said, "Are you Mr. Kotke?" And I just handed them my ticket. I said, "Well, yeah," thinking they were confusing me with my uncle who used to sell golf equipment. And that's happened more than once. "Oh, are you Leo?" And I said, "Yeah, I am. You used to sell golf equipment." But no, they wanted to know if it was me because his next sentence was, "We have destroyed your guitar." One of them, the other one survived. They said, "Would you like to see it?" Now, I hadn't even gotten onto the plane yet. You know, I just checked it at the ticket counter. That's all that happened. It arrived down there with the baggage handlers. In its new condition, and they brought that up to me in a sack. It's just a bunch of pieces in a sack that they tape together. It's all squashed. It was just, when they break, they usually snap the tuning head, they might crack the top, they might split the side. Sometimes, rarely, the neck will be whacked off. Usually it's this thing, the tuning head, and you can't play it, it's hanging out here like John. This time it was just pieces, all of them about this big, maybe a little bigger, in a sack. And I just looked at it, and the plane is boarding now, and I opened the sack so I could commune with, you know, the remains, basically. And I was about to hand the mess back to them because they wondered if I wanted it. And I was going to hand it back to them, and I remembered, there's a pickup in there. I could salvage a pickup. So I reached in, and I yanked the pickup out of one of the pieces of wood, and the guy said, "Well, you'll never play that guitar again." The nowhere can't be done for one thing, and you end up. I think this is why there are monasteries, actually. You have to like this introduction an awful lot. A song that I quit doing for another one that I stopped doing for a long time. It just started surfacing again. Hello, tune. I'm the guy who didn't marry pretty family man. Educated, well intentioned, good girl in our town. I wonder where I'd probably be driving kids to school. I guess I owe it all to Pamela. All of my good times, all my running around. One of these days I might be in your town, and I guess I owe it all to Pamela. I've seen the lights of cities, and I've been inside the door, sailed to foreign countries and walked upon that shore. I guess the guy she married was the best part of my life. Dug in cause he drove a pickup truck. Yes, I owe it all to Pamela Brown. All of my good times, all my running around. I might be in your town. And I guess I owe it all.
Thank you.
A few years ago, the record label decided that we needed a record release party for the debut of, you know, another one of these records. And when I realized how many I'd made, it was too late to stop. And we all complain, you know, most of us, to the label about the promotion that they're not doing. On the other hand, they'll call you and tell you that at 6:30 tomorrow, you'll gotta be in the television studio with the weatherman in Twin Falls, Idaho to talk about your new record. So that they can capture that enormous market there in Twin Falls that exists for solo guitar music. But this year, we put out a record with a title my manager came up with, Great Big Boy, because it's in a line somewhere in one of the tunes. I have to learn never to listen to him. This is, after all, the guy who says things to me like, Leo, I think, only here's how he sounds like it.
Leo, I think you're in.
It's like that. It's a cartoon. It's right out of that. If The Simpsons had a manager in the cast, it would be my manager. Which is one of the reasons I'm still working with him. And he said, I don't know, there's some problem. All they are is babysitters. I had some problem I was complaining about. He said, Leo, I think you're making the wrong mistake. He says stuff like, put that in the back of your pocket. I write these down. The ball is in your lap. My favorite, this is a masterpiece, was when I was having some trouble with a promoter in Northeast somewhere, and which almost never happens, because I'm not the kind of act that a promoter is going to give any trouble to. You know, we all make a buck, nothing's wrong. Very often I'm booked just because they've had a run on 10-piece bands for the last couple weeks, and they want to give their crew a break. Take it easy, you know, find some way to detoxify the dressing rooms. And so they bring me in, you know, and I sit in there, soak up the toxicity, stagger out on stage, and do my stuff. It's really true, and I'm easy to get. You know, they know that if they call, somebody will call back right away, and that I'll probably do it. Leo will do it. You know, I'd really like to play, so I'll go there. You know, I'll play wherever you, you know, it's, I don't often turn work down. And, but this particular job, something had really gone haywire. I'd been ripped off, or I was about to be ripped off, or there's some issue about support acts or something, or whatever. The sound system was a one-way made by Heath Kitt in 1932. You know, the microphone had a little crank on it, so you could... And I was complaining, you know, I was talking to Chuck, I was stuck in a motel somewhere, And what are we going to do? God, I don't know. This son of a damn, what are we doing? And Chuck finally said, look, Leo, don't worry about it. We'll beat him off at the pass. Isn't that great? So I said, well, you beat him off at the pass. He doesn't know. He says these things. He'll say, well, what'd I say? Thank you. Song that I named this after Elijah Williams, who was known as the Bristol Sloth. He's on record as being the slowest chess player in the history of the game. The Bristol Sloth is one of the reasons they invented the chess clock. He averaged in a tournament in 1851 in London, he averaged 2.5 hours per move. And the people who wrote about this guy suggested that he had invented thereby Sitzkrieg as a concept. Their opponent would, you know, die. And there are a few, you know, a friend of his, these guys. guys were actually pals. A friend of his was playing Paul Morphy, who was the first chess international star. And Morphy had been waiting for about 2 hours while this, you know, acolyte of the Bristol Sloth, you know, just tried to drip this guy to death with second after second after second. And Morphy, who was a member of the Romantic school of chess, isn't that something? There, you know, there's a classical, a romantic, a neo something, the barricade or Soviet school of chess, where nothing happens. They aren't playing slowly, they just aren't doing anything. Anatoly Karpov was the greatest at that, and that's why Garry Kasparov is such a hero. It's not because he's a genius, it's because he, from within the system, he destroyed this barricade idea. I mean, somebody once asked Anatoly Karpov what he did for a good time, and he said, stamp collecting and the study of Marxism. You don't want a guy like that playing chess. And after, you know, one or two of these interminable moves, Morphy is sitting there again. It's been a couple of hours. And he finally says to this guy, are you going to make your move? And the guy says, oh, is it my move? Really, there have been not a few chess murders, and I suspect that's the way some of them have. But I only mention that because this is on the new record. I've played one or two things on it, from it so far. Because that was the point of this record release party that the label put up for me. And I played this thing, this was about 15 years ago, played this thing, and they spent an enormous amount of money on a tent, a sound system, getting a crowd in, the catering, the bar, all this stuff, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to promote, you know, some record that I had made. And when I was done, the president, who's still a friend of mine, came up to me, Ron Goldstein, and he said, well, what are you thinking? Thanked him and I told him what I thought. I thought it was amazing and wonderful. And must have cost a fortune. And thanks for all the promotion. And, you know, I hope I can, you know, hope I can support this thing as much and as well. And he said, well, you got up there today and here at the record release party and played for an hour and a half and you didn't play anything off of the record. So I'd like to play something else from the new record today. Because ever since then, I figured that I deserve the title of Mr. Show Business. I'd like to try and live up to it. This will not be slow like the Bristol Sloth, but no one could ever match that virtuosity. Thank you. despite the fact that when I sent him a tape, everybody in the offices at Tacoma Records, I say offices, but in the office at Tacoma Records, said, oh, why put him out? He sounds just like you. John said, oh, I don't know, I didn't put him out. Put it out, and I got my job. Why am I telling you this? See, you try not to be thinking when you're up here. That's because if you're thinking, it's going to feel like you're thinking, and that's the worst. And you won't be able to think fast enough to know what the hell it is you were thinking about, which is just now happening to me. And as a result, here I stand. I did find out, apropos of nothing, that John's, I never knew this, that John's middle name was Aloysius. I went to, at his funeral, I looked down at his tombstone, and there it was, John Aloysius Fahey. He was a very complicated guy, and I think I figured out why. When he was 13 years old, his mother made him take tap dancing lessons. I can't think of anything worse, really. Unless you know, if he wanted to do a tap, that'd be a different story, but, you know, he didn't want to. And anyhow, in the fullness of time, he wound up putting out a record called Blind Joe Death as part of in pursuit of some other stuff. It moved around. Got a record going, and he recorded people like Charlie Nothing and his psychedelic saxophone, which is what he attributed his first divorce to. Charles Bukowski, he recorded a couple live readings by Mr. Bukowski, whose only requirement for the job was a refrigerator on stage full of beer. And when the beer was gone, so would Charles be gone. That's how he spent time to set. It was a, you know, real honor to be there among these people. It really was. You never ever knew what to expect. This is the tune. Now I got it. Now I remember. This is the tune that, because after I made the record for John, he wanted to start a production company so that, you know, he could spend less time on the road and beat up on other guitar players in the studio. And we went, so they signed me to Capitol, where I stayed for about 6 records. And on the first record, John was in the studio listening to this mess we were making out front there. He was in the control room. And he heard the vocal on this tune. John never liked my voice until later on, when I had changed and he had changed. He heard this tune, he heard the vocal, and he left. Quit. Stone on the water, I can't
Thank you.
1976, and I remember spending 3 days in a motel room in Adelaide between jobs, listening during a drought and listening to Bella Via, and over and over and over and over and over again. Statue of him in Melbourne on a street, something like Beale Street. I mean, you know, the same kind of deal. Only there they have a statue of Adrian Rollins, who's the guy who first imitated for me the mating call of the bull koala. It's like a bull mosquito. Or about this, you know, they are mean, but, you know, a bull koala. And I said, yeah, sure, I'd love to hear that. And it was really an anticlimactic kind of experience. I mean, anybody could do it. It's just, and that's why they built a statue to him, you know, I guess. He would write reviews. I remember one. He sent me this one. Of an Eartha Kitt performance. And he said the only way he could think to describe the perfection of her performance was that it must have been what it would be like to be in Mistin Gay's dressing room and smelling her tutu. So they built a statue to him in Melbourne. Eartha Kitt, so I review her. You want to pay someone a compliment, you maybe have to think twice or do them a favor. And you never know. I mean, even with a lot of forethought, it might go wrong. I've had a few things backfire on me. I had the flu one night, and when I had to take a break, I was sick. I took a break, I came back out, and somebody had left a warm hair and cheese pie on my chair. It's one of the reasons I'm standing up tonight. Oh, I can still smell it. It can be a weird Jimmy Reed was playing with his son, and Jimmy was up in years now. Just great R&B stuff, and his son was a bass player. They were playing, and Jimmy just sort of passed out, hit the floor. In the middle of his tune, in the middle of his set. And his son, having been raised by a professional musician, just ignored him and kept playing. And when Jimmy came to, he looked up at his son, who's got a cigarette in his mouth, and he said, "No smoking on stage." Must be uphold this professionalism at all times. So I got out of Adelaide, out of the drought, and some years later on another tour there, and I go there every couple of years. My God, that thing is loud. Where is that thing? Is that just picking up through the fills? I mean, we don't have to get rid of it. I just wish it was a little more, you know, I wish its timing was more, it was cooler. Anyhow, I got to Sydney, and my room was flooding. There was this huge storm. And the water was vertical. It was maybe a monsoon, something Australian, you know, like they have there, just real extremes. You can be eaten at any time of day in Darwin if you're hanging around there, and one of the saltwater crocodiles comes across you, you'll be hit. They're huge, they're hungry, and they just, there's nothing you can do about them. Just stay indoors. There are, it's either 13 or 18 fatal spiders if you're bitten by them, many of whom prefer urban environments. And they have no concept of size. You know, it's like a puppy attacking a mastiff. They just don't think. They're a spider. The funnel spider sits in a little crack. It likes cracks. It likes cement, bricks. So it's right there on the sidewalk. It sits in there with this funnel. And it waits for things to come by, and it comes out, grabs them, and pulls it down in the funnel. Having no idea of size, it comes out and grabs you, who are bigger, really, than the funnel. But its bite will kill you. It's a great place to tour, you know. You have a lot of things to think about. Horizontal rain, and I was sitting there, and the room flooded. It was just blowing right into the room. Everything was plugged in. I figured there's current in that floor. So I had nothing to do but sit on the couch where this all began and play. And I came up with at least part of this. It's called Snorkel. Sneak up on the end of this with this at the end of this, I will play this near the, at the end of the performance, and go back to Mrs. Fricks in my eighth grade grammar class when I have the time. It's always a privilege to play, and it's really nice to be back here. The system has really been upgraded here. And back there, it was kind of toxic back there at one time. It's not anymore. It's real nice. This is called Gevirgige Beat. Gevirgige Beat, and it's the most beautiful word in the German language. Language not ordinarily lauded for its beauty. To my ear, it's magnificent. The language of my grandparents, and one that I remain to this day completely insensible to. I cannot learn the language. I play there all the time. I cannot learn the language. So I've just selected a couple of the really good words and tried to learn them. In the process, I've discovered that I had a relative who died when she was 23. She was more than a relative, because somebody in Hamburg brought me a playbill from one of her last concerts in Berlin. The year she died, it was like 1910, she specialized in Bach and Liszt, and she was a big hit in Germany, and especially in Berlin. So, 1910, at any rate. And they said, we thought you should see this. And they handed me the playbill, and there was a photograph of this woman whose name was Katka. I've forgotten her first name, Leona, probably. And I looked at the photograph, and there's a woman standing, you know, against the piano like this. She's got this enormous bustle in that kind of, that hair helmet thing that was happening at the time, and it was me. I was about 23 at the time they showed me this, and it was me, you know. And I didn't know, you know, I couldn't speak really, and I kind of handed it back to them, and they said, "We think you're related." So I have a chance now. I mean, I really did kind of freak out. I'm not saying that we looked a lot alike or there was a family resemblance. It was just, it was me. And I thought about it off and on, and I think maybe I wanted to play something more portable than a piano, something that I could tune by myself. And I had to die and change my gender to do it. It really sounds like something I would do. So, I can't play this without thinking of her or me. And it is on the new record. The label may have shipped some here. If they're selling them out there, I have nothing to do with it. We've already soaked you for the ticket. A little freedom from the marketplace doesn't hurt. So, thank you again. Hope I see you. Thank you. Thank you. This is the oldest thing I've got. That one.